It's 50 languages now for 50 Shades of Grey. In the weeks before the Frankfurt Book Fair, self-published authors no longer find themselves on the outside looking in. Just ask E.L. James. In reviews, Foodopoly, the battle over the future of food and farming in America, asserts that politics is an ingredient on every American's dinner plate. Welcome, everyone, to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. My name is Christopher Keneally, host of Beyond the Book, and each week on Friday, we turn to the writers and editors of Publishers Weekly for a look at the week ahead, a preview of the news that has everyone in publishing talking. Joining me, as he does almost always from New York, is Andrew Albanese, the magazine's features editor. Welcome back, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
Well, we have you in your regular office this week with some news about a new book just out that's getting quite a lot of attention, but that makes sense because it's only by the world's wealthiest author.
That's right, J.K. Rowling's Casual Vacancy. The big news this week was that the reviews of the book are now out and that they were put out despite an embargo that the publisher had placed on the book. I think it was the Daily News in New York and the AP that had eventually just blown by the embargo and published the reviews. Now, frankly, I think for Rowling and for Hachette, there has to be sort of a sense of relief here that her first adult book since Harry Potter is now out there. And with the embargo broken, I should add, the PW review is also up on the Publishers Weekly site, and it's pretty decent, I have to say. I think the first review in the Daily News was, as you'd expect from a tabloid, pretty sensational, and it kind of hits the author's and publisher's worst fears that, you know, Rowling is going to kind of have to battle her Harry Potter past to be accepted as a literary novelist. But I think the reviews also suggest that, you know, Rowling can indeed write for adults, so I think that's a good thing. Now, the other part of the story, the embargo busting, putting this review out despite a strict embargo by publishers that this be held. Now, on the positive side of that, I think Hachette should probably be thrilled because the embargo story has suddenly put Rowling's book into the news in a really, really big way with a lot of, you know, off the book page coverage, and that should probably help generate sales. We'll see how that goes. But as for the ethics of breaking an embargo, personally, you know, a lot of people got very worked up about this. I'm not so worked up about it, you know, because it kind of happens all the time. As a reporter, I know I personally hate embargoes. I honor them. I try to talk people out of using them. But frankly, someone always seems to break an embargo that I'm obeying. And I find that very frustrating. And there really is very little backlash that happens against people that break embargoes. And I also think that embargoes were probably more important back in the day when you actually had to set type and prepare to publish. And with this new sort of push button publishing of the digital world, that embargoes are almost a relic. And yet I have to say, from a journalist's point of view, I'm seeing more and more stuff coming through with embargoes on them. Now, for something like a product launch or review, I certainly understand the use of an embargo. You know, you want to make sure that you're actually ready to sell something when the press starts to hit. It's about coordination of marketing and all that good stuff. But at the same time, in my experience, more and more organizations are trying to actually control news in ways that I think are frankly unrealistic and sometimes even unethical via the use of the embargo. So while the conversation is going to be both about Rowling's new book and whether or not it's a worthwhile read, it's also today about the ethics of embargoes. And I think we should also be talking about the ethics of setting embargoes when we have that conversation. You know, I know you probably bump up against this too, Chris. I wonder if you have any thoughts on it.
Well, certainly I do. And, you know, you make a great point, I think, Andrew, that this is a two-way street here. And there is a... I'm not sure if it's so much an ethical issue so much as a kind of business-like demand to put these embargoes in place because they really want to control the market. And I think in some sense, if you do want to make that ethical, it's a kind of cheating of your customer. But I'm more concerned, frankly, as a former journalist myself, with the whole notion that the honor system isn't really in place any longer, that we have a kind of situational ethics. People decide which embargoes they will honor and which ones they won't. And I would rather, you know, you either say I'm never going to honor one or I am. And you can't really have it both ways.
Oh, that's a good point. Yep.
Well, now we do know that Casual Vacancy, the new novel, the first adult literary novel from J.K. Rowling, published by Hachette, is not going to be available to libraries in ebook format, and that just brings home this continuing story you follow for us around the library ebook issue. We've had an exchange this week of letters and a meeting in New York yesterday. So where do the two sides stand, publishers and librarians?
Well, that's true. The ebook issue in libraries is definitely heated up this week, and you know Hachette does not put its front list ebooks available for lending in libraries. So yeah, unless there's a special agreement that I'm not yet made aware of between Rowling and Hachette, no, that book is not going to be available for library lending. And you know, as you referenced, yes, there was a meeting yesterday in New York between ALA leadership and a group of publishers convened by AAP. It was a tame meeting, we'll say. For a very eventful week, it turned out to be a very cordial meeting. Now, as expected, you don't expect fireworks to really fly at these events. I think that the ALA very ably got up and made its point to the publishing community that what it really wants here is equitable access to information at reasonable prices for its people. And right now, it just doesn't have that when it comes to ebooks. Libraries are blocked from buying ebooks at all at a number of the Big Six publishers. And they have to pay very large prices for access to ebooks from other publishers. Now, Sullivan and the ALA talk at AAP yesterday comes on the heels of an open letter that you talked about. That open letter called out the Big Six publishers, especially for refusing to sell ebooks to libraries or of those that do, charging those exorbitant prices. And notably, that letter seems to mark a pretty significant shift in strategy for the library community. They're now taking the ebook discussions out of the boardrooms, discussions that have been going on for the last year, and they're starting to make their case directly to the public, directly to library patrons. And on one side, that drew a pretty sharp response from AAP that said it was, disappointed with the ALA's letter. But frankly, I'm glad that this letter is out there, and I hope this sort of mild tiff that kicked off this week, at least mild as in it was portrayed at yesterday's meeting, I hope this escalates into a shouting match, to be perfectly honest. I hope it gets into, a cordial shouting match, but nevertheless a shouting match that's so loud that our citizens and lawmakers and policymakers do pay attention to it. Because the fact is, I don't think the Big Six publishers are really going to do much of anything on their own when it comes to ebooks. In my opinion, I don't believe that there's anyone at ALA who can ever say anything to a corporate executive at a Big Six publisher that's going to change their minds about the library ebook issue. So I think we're at a point now where there needs to be more involvement by both the public and by policymakers. So I say, bring it on. Now, speaking personally and not speaking for my esteemed employer, Publishers Weekly, I'll say this much. I don't think ALA is being terribly bold, and I think it's actually been pretty gentle, in my opinion, with some of its criticisms so far. The publishers so far, their response, I think, has been a little tone deaf. Libraries are feeling the immediate effects of not having ebooks more so than publishers are right now. And I think publishers are kind of blowing this because librarians are really popular. Libraries are really popular. Publishers, not so much. And if publishers think that this is an issue worth picking a fight over with their best customers, I think they may be in for something of a surprise. I have to say, for what? I happen to believe that enabling ebook lending by libraries probably would help publishers. I don't know. But I do tend to believe that. And I'm having a hard time myself understanding the publisher point of view on this. I think publishers, frankly, should be eagerly working with libraries and using libraries to sort of form a bulwark against those things that really do threaten them, like Amazon, perhaps. But even more so, it would be nice to see, the publishers kind of try to duck a blow or two here, with the DOJ stuff. And it seems like the publishing industry is always facing some kind of public-facing PR nightmare. I think that there's a way that they can use libraries to actually, help them out. I think libraries and publishers are really in this together.
Well, I have to admire, Andrew, your full-throated defense of libraries and librarians. As somebody who spent an hour or two of my life in those hallowed halls. I certainly respect what you're trying to say there. And the notion of working together than fighting it out does make a lot of sense. Self-publishing is transforming the publishing business. And in Monday's issue, some more evidence of the real growth there, and particularly how it all plays out at the Frankfurt Book Fair.
That's right. Monday also comes with our latest issue of PW Select, which is our supplement dedicated to self-publishing. You know, and I think most publishers would kind of sneer at the idea that self-publishing is you know, really a big part of the industry or something that might threaten their traditional revenues. I think they're all looking to find a way to get in on the gravy train now. You know, in Monday's issue, in fact, just ahead of the Frankfurt Book Fair, our Rachel Diehl has a great story about what seems to be a lot of interest in 50 Shades of Grey-like books that are going to be at this year's Frankfurt Book Fair. And she notes that Random House, you know, as you noted as well, just sold 50 Shades into its 50th language. Now, as you know, these books were initially self-published. The E.L. James book were initially self-published. And as Rachel finds in her article, there's a significant uptick in the number of American agents who are taking books to this year's fair that were originally self-published. So clearly, I think self-published is establishing itself as viable, as a moneymaker, actually, as a place to find new talent. And while for now it seems to be feeding authors into the major publishers, at least for authors that have potential breakout books like 50 Shades of Grey. I think there's an uneasy truth here that maybe Amazon holds a bit of an advantage here, because you can start to see that the midlist is starting to shift to the Kindle, it's starting to shift to CreateSpace. Books that are no longer finding purchase on the midlist at these publishing houses are being self-published and sold through, you know, places like Amazon. I think it's going to be really interesting at this year's Frankfurt Book Fair to see how self-publishing is represented. Anyway, you want to check out Rachel's story in Monday's issue.
Yes, indeed we will. And, you know, we'll score one for authors when it comes to self-publishing, but the publishers still have a bit of fight left in them. And one publisher in particular is taking some writers to court to get back some money.
Yeah. You know, when I said that little thing about, you know, publishers wanting to duck or blow or two here, this falls into that category. We learned on Monday of this week that from The Smoking Gun, of all places, that Penguin is actually suing a bunch of authors for breach of contract and unjust enrichment for advances on undelivered books. Now, this is pretty much almost unheard of in publishing. And, you know, between the, you know, the library books and the DOJ debacle, you know, Penguin, in fact, is getting sued by an employee for discrimination. That's been in the papers and in the press. And now we've got them fighting it out with authors over, you know, what's pretty small chunks of advance money. I think Prozac Nation author Elizabeth Wurzel is being sued for $33,000. A blogger, Anna Marie Cox, who signed in 2006, is being sued for $81,000 at about $50,000 in interest. This one astonishes me. Rebecca Mead, who's a staff writer at The New Yorker, is getting sued for $20,000 for a 2003 contract. You know, it just doesn't look good. I know a few things first. You know, none of these authors really are getting rich on these deals. They may sound like a lot of money, but when you factor in the amount of work it takes to write a book, it's really not. You know, we don't know all the details yet, but the amount of money spent litigating these things could easily outstrip the amount of money they'd recover. You know, let's face it, $20,000 to Rebecca Mead, who's I think is awesome and is a very, very diligent writer, that's a lot more consequential to Rebecca Mead than it is to a multi-billion-dollar company like Penguin. So I don't know why they would risk the litigation headlines there. But this is why you see so few of these suits. You know, first, I think it's very hostile to authors. You know, part of you may say a contract is a contract, but, you know, writing a book is not like painting a house. You know, just because someone fails to deliver a book or it doesn't come in based on a schedule that's been put out for you doesn't mean that the author didn't work hard at it. And frankly, when the book doesn't come in, it can often be, you know, as much the editor's fault as it is the author's. And I think also that, you know, Robert Gottlieb from Trident, an agency, a big agency here in New York, commented that if Penguin ever sued one of his authors, they'd never see another submission again. So I have to wonder, I don't know what Penguin is thinking about this, but it's definitely not a good headline for them this week. But, you know, we don't know the details, so we'll stay tuned.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, Andrew, I turned to an old friend of mine who was a senior editor at one of the major houses for many, many years, and I asked him what he thought about this. And he said, well, it's a tough one, but if he had a choice, he went after the SOBs and left the widows alone.
Well, I'll tell you, as a former editor myself, I've had a few books under contract that, you know, were lingering and not yet coming in. And usually if this is going to happen, the way it happens is you just, you know, you make a decision to cancel the contract and you work out something that's called first proceeds, where, you know, you let the author sell the book someplace else and you get your advance back out of that advance. That's generally the way it goes. But I think publishing is becoming less of the gentleman's industry that it used to be, and a bit more business-like, shall we say?
Yes, indeed. Andrew Albanese, PW Features Editor, chatting with us today from his office in New York City. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
And now I want to turn to Sam Slayton. Welcome, Sam Slayton. You're the Nonfiction Reviews Editor at Publishers Weekly. Great to have you on Beyond the Book.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, you know, I should mention that you are coming to us in place of our usual review of reviews person, Rose Fox. And so it's great to have you. We're looking forward to what perspective you bring. You're a specialist in nonfiction, so I think that's pretty important. And what kind of books have we got this week?
Well, we're going to start out in fiction. In fiction, we've got two box reviews. Liz Jensen's The Uninvited is a creepy and effective novel about the strange connections between an epidemic outbreak of corporate sabotage and a tribe of murderous children with a group consciousness and their own language. Sent around the world to investigate the odd goings-on is Hesketh Locke, a cross-culture specialist employed with a multinational legal firm. In an unusual twist, Hesketh is an anthropologist whose Asperger's syndrome allows him to study human behavior at a remove. How everything finally plays out in the book is, we think, eerie and foreboding, leaving unanswered as many questions as it addresses. Christina Lynch, a TV writer, and Meg Howry, author of last year's Crane's Dance, unite under the pseudonym of Magnus Flight for City of Dark Magic, a breezy, lighthearted novel that cleverly combines time travel, murder, history, and musical lore. A woman researching her PhD in neurological musicology in Boston receives a letter summoning her to Prague to help establish the relationship between the heir to a Czech fortune and Ludwig van Beethoven, but she's warned that Prague is a threshold to dark magic, passion, and violence, and she suspects that mysteries await. Also in next week's issue is a Q&A with HTML giant editor Blake Butler. We talked to him about his new novel, Sky Saw, out in December from Tyrant Books. When asked about the distinction between post and pre-apocalyptic, Butler said, quote, "Apocalypse culture isn't interesting to me because it dates itself inside a space where the end is all and all is dead. I don't see that in my writing, as bleak as some people feel it may be. When I write a scene that concerns itself with something sick, like children hurting their mother or foam rising over a continent, it's not because there's nothing left. It's because there's something there still to be destroyed."
What a thought, Sam Slayton. Speaking of destruction, in the mystery and thriller department, bodies are piling up two by two.
That's right, in a macabre arc. It's in Good Junk, Ed Kovacs' second mystery set in post-Katrina New Orleans, Private Eye Cliff St. James investigates a double murder-suicide. Now, since both victims worked for the Defense Department, he encounters more than a little federal interference in the case. The wisecracking St. James may be a familiar genre type, but Kovacs' evocation of a city still struggling to recover its infrastructure and identity lifts this well beyond most other contemporary crime novels. Bow Street runner Matthew Hawkwood looks into two bizarre murders in James McGee's Resurrectionist. In a London graveyard, a man's corpse has been nailed to a tree in a crude parody of the crucifixion, while a body turns up in Bedlam, the city's notorious hospital for the insane, with no face. McGee mixes action and detection perfectly in this Regency crime thriller.
In science fiction, Sam, there's more bodies turning up.
That's right, body after body here. Peter F. Hamilton's standalone sci-fi mystery, Great North Road, is mesmerizing and enormous. Clocking in at nearly 1,000 pages, it's a good thing this is a fast-paced page-turner. In the year 2143, a naked corpse dragged from the river proves to be a member of the North family, which contains hundreds of identical clones of brothers Augustine, Bartram, and Constantine North. The wounds on the dead North, whose exact identity is vexingly hard to pin down, match those on Bartram's body after he and his household were slaughtered in 2121. Angela Tremolo, convicted of those murders, always claimed that an alien monster was the real culprit. The intense whodunit plot and the sustained ambiguity surrounding Tremolo's innocence or guilt are enhanced by plausible extrapolations of 22nd century human cultures. Now, shifting gears and jumping back a few hundred years, Sophie Lewis has developed a delightful new translation of Jules Verne's 1889 satirical farce, The Earth Turned Upside Down, which has modern-day resonance in its critique of man's hubris and concern for rising sea levels. The North Polar Exploitation Association aims to take ownership of the North Pole, after which they plan to shift the tilt of the Earth so that the polar regions become ice-free and can be mined for coal. Though protests come from around the world, the explorers brazenly continue with the project. Period attitudes toward women and people of color are portrayed in detail that may be off-putting to some modern readers, but Verne eases the sting by mercilessly mocking the association's disdain for, quote, less civilized cultures.
Well, indeed, Verne, as always, prescient in a book I have never heard of. That sounds fascinating. In romance, what have we got?
Well, after the recent release of the contemporary romance Love in a Nutshell, the prolific Janet Ivanovich teams up once again with Dorian Kelly on The Husband List, their first historical romance together. American heiress Caroline Maxwell wants independence and passion in a marriage, maybe with her brother's ne'er-do-well friend Jack, but that's too much to ask in high society in 1894, especially as Caroline's mother is set on marrying her daughter off to a mysterious English duke. The authors paint a clear picture of the luxurious lives of the ultra-wealthy, cycling in Central Park, scampering around Newport's Cliff Walk, and taking tea in London's finest drawing rooms. Whether running away from her governess or from the Duke, captivating Caroline maintains her feisty streak, and her straightforward character is fully fleshed out with intelligence and humor. And in our romance Q&A, we talked with Beth Chioda, author of the steampunk romance adventure Her Sky Cowboy. She tells us exactly how she got the idea for a setting in which the Victorian era has been invaded by time-traveling peace rebels from the 1960s who hope to alter the past to prevent 20th century atrocities.
Well, you know, Sam, as your colleague Rose Fox knows, I kind of struggle with the whole steampunk thing, but it appeals to a great many people. Now we turn to your sweet spot, which is the nonfiction section.
That's right. Over in the nonfiction category, we start with award-winning poet Melanie Challenger imbuing her book On Extinction, How We Became Estranged from Nature, with the courage of an explorer, the scientific curiosity of a botanist and a geologist, the excited digging of an archaeologist, the compassion of a cultural anthropologist, the long reach of a historian, and the urgent concern of an environmentalist. She travels from a writer's solitary cabin on the Ding Dong Moor. That's right, Ding Dong Moor, that's a real place, close by the ruins of a tin mine in Cornwall, England, to the bottom of the world with the British Antarctic Survey. At every stop on what she calls her peregrination, she muses on evolutionary changes marked by extinctions past and present. Throughout this beautifully written, moving, and important book, Challenger yearns to find that feeling of belonging to a particular place. Her connection, one comes to feel, is to the past and present of our whole precarious planet. Over in Foodopoly, the battle of the future of food and farming in America, a meticulously researched tour de force, author Winona Hawter, the executive director of Food and Water Watch, examines the pernicious effects of consolidation in every sector of the food industry. Not only has deregulation and the elimination of antitrust laws led to a significant reduction of competition, it has failed to allow the consumer to benefit from the economies of scale achieved by larger production facilities. More dangerous for our democracy, Hawter argues, is that the surviving firms have used their wealth to capture the political system in order to rewrite the regulations for their benefit. And just in time for fireside reading season, Robert Gottlieb offers Great Expectations, The Sons and Daughters of Charles Dickens, wherein he profiles each of the 10 Dickens children, 7 sons, 3 daughters, one of whom died in infancy, and discusses the scandalous possible existence of an 11th child, a son born to Ellen Ternan, Dickens' probable mistress. The book is divided into 2 separate chronological sections delineated by Dickens' death in 1870, a structural choice that reenacts the way in which Dickens held ultimate control over the life narratives of his children and demonstrates just how large his shadow loomed as both an excellence-demanding father and a disappointment-doling ghost. The smart and accessible biography is written in a clever, conversational tone that radiates coziness and keeps the pages swiftly turning.
Well, from Dickens' children to children's books, we've got some picture books to review.
On the picture book side, we've got a review of Otter and Otter, A Love Story by James Howe, whom readers and picture book lookers may know as the man behind the Bunnicula series, and illustrated by Krish Rashka, who won the Caldecott Medal last year for A Ball for Daisy. It's the story of an otter who experiences love at first sight with the fish he's about to eat. A crisis of conscience ensues, and the odd otter is left to ponder. Can you truly love your food source? Quote, it isn't natural, say the other otters. It's a frequently funny story, and Rashka's childlike crayon and watercolor artwork is fantastic. But more importantly, it works as a lovely allegory for relationships that fall outside what's considered to be the mainstream and raises some smart questions along the way. In children's fiction, we review Andrew Smith's Passenger, the sequel to 2010's The Marbury Lens, which is probably one of the most brutal and difficult YA novels of the past few years. Passenger is no different. Here, 16-year-old Jack and his friends learn that the nightmarish alternate world of Marbury is much larger and more complex than they realized, and that escaping it is all but impossible. As with the previous book, there's an incredible amount of gore and ugliness as Jack tries to protect his friends and find his way home. But Smith makes the journey worthwhile, wrapping up Jack's story in a way that isn't exactly happy, but feels honest and real. Elsewhere in the kids section, we have a roundup of 6 new poetry collections, as well as 2 exceptional nonfiction accounts of African American history.
And finally, Sam, what do we have for the pick of the week?
For our pick of the week, Chris, we went with Egyptologist Gary Shaw's The Pharaoh, Life at Court and on Campaign, a delightful and lavishly illustrated guide wherein the fascinating lives and times of the rulers of the Nile are rendered in elaborate detail. Drawing on archaeological and literary evidence, Shaw reconstructs the lives of pharaohs, detailing everything from their inheritance of the throne to their favorite pastimes and their elevation to divinity. This captivating study is the perfect introduction to these fabled rulers.
Sam Slayton, Nonfiction Reviews Editor at Publishers Weekly, thanks so much for this week's review of reviews.
Thanks, Chris. Bye-bye.
And just before we close out the show this week, I want to bring back Andrew Albanese and take note of the fact that we are starting our 2nd year in the podcast series.
Hey, happy anniversary, Chris. And to our engineer, Jeremy, as well.
Absolutely. And to Rose, who's not with us this week, we miss her and we'll look forward to getting her back soon. And, you know, I have to say, it's been a tremendous opportunity to speak with you every week, Andrew. I learn a lot about the business that I just can't follow on my own. And certainly, as well, and unexpectedly, the review of the reviews gives me a glimpse of what's being published and what readers are looking for.
Well, I have to say, we really enjoy being able to visit with you and with your audience and our readers every week doing this as well. And we look forward to continue doing so in the next year.
Absolutely. And you'll be traveling to Frankfurt very soon. So you'll be reporting for us right from the floor of the Frankfurt Book Fair Show in a couple of weeks.
Beer in hand, I hope.
That's right. All right. Andrew Albanese, again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. And happy anniversary.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the podcast series on iTunes or at the Copyright Clearance Center website, copyright.com. Just click on Beyond the Book. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.